Powers. Good to have you with us this morning, day three of this panel sitting. Last day and the best day, no doubt. So we have four cases to hear. We may take a brief recess at some point. First case of the morning, Woodlands Pride et al. Versus Warren Kenneth Paxton et al. I think Mr. Cole gets to go first.
Thank you, Judge Southwick, and may it please the court. In 2023, the Texas legislature passed SB 12, a law that restricts the performance of certain statutorily defined sexually oriented performances in the presence of minors. Now, despite what plaintiffs and their amici have been saying in this court and the district court and even the court of public opinion for more than a year, SB 12 does not bar or ban the performance of the theatrical drag shows that they've said they wish to perform, and particularly not as they've defined those shows at trial. Now, the district court, in concluding to the contrary, committed a multiplicity of jurisdictional and merits-based errors, and this morning I'd like to focus on three broad points related to those errors. The first is that plaintiffs failed to prove at trial Article III jurisdiction, both because they failed to identify an injury in fact, and even if they had, that those injuries are not traceable to the Attorney General. A second, and even if the court were to conclude there's jurisdiction, SB 12 does not violate the First Amendment by regulating any inherently expressive conduct, and certainly not as a facial matter, and I think that's particularly clear after the Supreme Court's decision in Moody. And third and finally, if we get there, SB 12 passes any level of constitutional scrutiny, which in this case, after Free Speech Coalition against Paxton, we would suggest to the court is rational basis. Now, before I get there, I'd like to start with jurisdiction, if I might. Now, plaintiff's theory of injury, in fact, in this case, is that SB 12 chills their speech based on a credible threat of enforcement. And now, this court's case law suggests that in order to make that showing, they need to show that, and this is the words of the courts in Zimmerman, that these future injuries are either somehow inevitable, and I'd point to a good example of that, this Turtle Island Foods case, or else that the statute has been applied against others or themselves in the past. And for that, I would suggest Driehaus is a good example. Now, we're obviously not dealing with the enforcement in the past because this is a brand new statute that's never been enforced. So I think what plaintiffs needed to show at trial was that their injuries were inevitable. But you recall that essentially the tenor of their testimony at trial was that, well, we don't want to violate SB 12. In fact, we don't think that we violate SB 12. But our fear is that some other persons out there might think that some of the things that we're doing might violate SB 12. Now, on that theory, I think the Sixth Circuit's recent decision in Friend of George's is helpful, because there the Sixth Circuit addressed basically a similar argument and said as follows, that a party alleging that its conduct could be prescribed by the challenge statute cannot rely on an argument that the statute might be misconstrued by law enforcement or that it might be seen as violating the statute. Now, at trial, what you have here is plaintiffs define their drag shows as, and this is sort of what they want to do, theatrical performances involving the over-dramatization of a character or gender, often concerning celebrity lookalikes, and here's the conduct that they say that is typically marked by these performances, dancing, lip-syncing, engaging with the audience by hugging, kissing on the cheek, sometimes bumping hips. Now, none of that is even arguably barred by SB 12, and let's go to SB 12 if I can right now. Recall that the prescribed conduct is sexually oriented performances, and the statute defines that as either a visual performance that features either nudity or sexual conduct, defined in five ways, that appeals to the prurient interest in sex. Now, there's no testimony in the record that suggests plaintiffs want to engage in nudity. They all disclaimed that, and I think the only thing related to the nudity argument is that, well, they said, wait, there might be a wardrobe malfunction.
Does the statute define prurient interest?
Does the statute define prurient interest? No, the statute doesn't define prurient interest, but that's been defined.
How can we judge it then?
Well, because it's been defined in case law for nearly 75 years, going back to Roth in the Supreme Court. I mean, to the extent they're suggesting it's vague, this court's upheld vagueness challenges on prurient interest prong. It has a definable, knowable definition, and that is prurient does not, in the words it's...
How many definitions of prurient interest would we find in those sources you just mentioned?
How many definitions? They all point to the same meaning. The sources of the Supreme Court, this court, they all point to dictionary definitions, handful of dictionary definitions that all point towards the same meaning, Judge Dennis. So the meaning is, in the Supreme Court's word in Bennett versus Spokane Arcade, it's not something that appeals to a normal, sort of healthy sexual desire. It's something that's over and above that. It's morbid. It's one of the words is lascivious, which is, you know, $2.
How much over and above is it?
Substantially over and above. Now, I don't dispute...
Substantially over and above?
Yes, definitely. It's an unhealthy sexual desire. It's morbid. It's something far and above that. One example that we'd give to you on that is one of the performance we described at page 3 of our brief. But I think what you're getting at, Judge Dennis, is the Supreme Court has suggested that prurient interest is a jury question, and we don't dispute that. But there's an articulable standard that could be put in jury instructions for that. I think that's clear. I mean, I think the suggestion that it's vague would, if this court were to take that up, would have serious knockup.
What if the jury comes out and asks the judge, what is prurient interest?
Then the judge can define it. It's exactly what I'm saying. The judge can look to dictionary definitions to define it. The Ninth Circuit said that in Edge. I mean, it's pretty, I think, well established that prurient has survived multiple vagueness challenges across the years for 75 years. I mean, it's a word that finds its genesis in Supreme Court case law going back to Roth. I mean, for this court to hold that it is vague would, I think, have serious knock-on effects to other areas of law, like the criminal law, obscenity prosecutions, child prosecutions, where that is a common term. So I think the prurient interest prong, as we're discussing, does really cabin in the scope of this statute in a serious way. So the other two prongs that I was just mentioning at the top of the statute are nudity and sexual conduct. Now, we sort of discussed nudity. There's really nothing in the record to suggest that they want to engage in nudity at these shows. The only thing was a wardrobe malfunction, but as you'll note from our brief, a malfunction is not featured in a performance. It doesn't, that definition of the word feature is a defining characteristic of a performance. Something that's an aberration can't quite be that. So I'll turn to sort of sexual conduct, and it's defined in five ways, and the way I kind of look at this is in two buckets. There's five definitions. The first three are essentially exhibitions or representations, actual or simulated, of basically various sex acts, lewd displays of genitals, and the display of sex toys. Now, the plaintiffs here don't want to engage in any of that activity in front of minors. To the extent it goes on at all, it's at anything even arguably that goes on at all, it's at the early age-limited shows. So, you know, the best they can sort of say is, well, somebody might think a conga line is a simulated sex act, which, I've just never seen a conga line that represents that. I don't think that's reasonable. I think in the words of Zimmerman, it's wholly speculative and imaginary, or to start Hansen, fanciful. So that definition I don't think is met. The other sort of half of the statute, I'll say, is sort of simulated contact between one person and sort of the genitals, breast or buttock, to the other, and then sexual gesticulations. Now, we don't think they've said anything that meets those definitions, but even if you could squint at some of the stuff like sitting in laps and say that that meets the definition, I think the prurient interest prong then comes in to cabin that, as I was just discussing with Judge Dennis, because, again, prurient has a definable, knowable meaning. It is not, as the Supreme Court said, just normal, healthy sexual desires. It is over and above that. It is morbid. It is borderline offensive types of things.
So let me ask, with regard to the performers that would be the subject of the statute, there is an element of scienter, is that correct? In order for them, if they were to perform before a minor, which as I understand the statute is designed to prevent, is there not an element of intent that must be proven?
I think there certainly is, and you'll recall, Judge Engelhardt, that the statute has sort of three enforcement mechanisms. They're not subject to really any of them except for the criminal prosecution, and of course, Texas Penal Code 602 sets the mens rea there for recklessness. So yeah, it would be at a minimum recklessness for...
There must be an intent to arouse a prurient interest.
That's correct, Judge Dennis. Yeah, that's right. And particularly, again, for the performer.
If perjury in interest is not defined in the statute, this leaves a statute that could have many, many meanings, many different meanings, different people.
I don't think so. Again, jury instructions will set the definition of that. I mean, again, the best I can tell you there is that this court and others have upheld vagueness challenges as to this exact term for three quarters of a century. So I don't think it can be said that it's vague. To the extent that there are edge cases, and this is, I mean, United States versus Williams talks about this from the Supreme Court, the fact that you can imagine tough cases doesn't mean that it's vague. That just means, in the words of Justice Scalia for the majority there, that those things are weeded out by essentially the burden of proof. In a civil case, it would be obviously preponderance, but in a criminal case, beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I do want to touch on, for a moment, that we were talking about.
Before we move on to that.
Yes, sure.
The Attorney General's role in the statute, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, is limited to enforcement of civil penalties against commercial establishments. Is that correct? And the rest of the statute is for ordinances and those who enforce ordinances on a municipal or local level?
That's correct, Judge Engelhardt. Yeah, so Section 1 is the one that the Attorney General enforces, that civil penalties against those who control the premises of a commercial enterprise. Section 2 governs local government municipal regulations, and then 3 is the criminal penal code.
So your argument is that, as I understand it, is that the plaintiffs in this case, the performer plaintiffs in this case, really would have no claim against the Attorney General, since the Attorney General is only empowered by the statute to act upon establishments.
Undoubtedly so, Judge Engelhardt. Yes. Now, they, of course, argue that they do control the premises of a commercial enterprise. We don't think the statute admits of that reading. We think the verbs allow and control help flesh that out. When you look at the statutory structure, stepping back, obviously it's targeted at different persons, and they're not running these commercial businesses. They use them for a couple of hours. And so that's our traceability argument.
Also, you have several things you probably want to cover, but I want to hear about the First Amendment aspect of this and whether, in fact, these performances satisfy the expressive conduct on the First Amendment.
Well, you read my mind, Judge Southwick.
I didn't mean to, but...
So we don't think there's any First Amendment conduct here, but particularly not as a facial matter. Recall this is a facial pre-enforcement challenge, and I know you're familiar with those with Moody. But before I get to Moody, I'll say, if there's any bright lines in the First Amendment, it's between conduct and speech. There's no speech here, this is conduct. So they have to show that these performances are categorically, on the face of their statute, inherently expressive. Now, what does the statute regulate? It regulates particular types of things, nudity and sexual conduct. Now, we know that nudity is not inherently expressive. That's the Supreme Court said that in Pabst AM. This court has said that multiple times. So what do we have left? We have sexual conduct, and for that they cite sort of the cases governing strip clubs, where the Supreme Court has said the customary barroom type of nude dancing might be, under some circumstances, protected by the First Amendment to the extent that it conveys an erotic message. Now, I don't understand them to be claiming the protections of strip clubs, but if they were, obviously that would run them straight into the precedents under sort of Renton and the like, where we know that strip clubs can be age limited. So what's left is, well, what exactly is the inherently expressive message in displays of sex acts, displays, lewd displays of genitals, sex toys? How does one to know other than if some sort of speech is accompanied with it? And we know from Fair and cases like it that is not categorically inherently expressive on the face of the statute. Now, Moody, I think, to the extent you're sort of grappling around with those precedents, I think Moody sort of seals the deal because their overbreath challenge certainly can't succeed after Moody. I mean, I think that was clear before Moody, but Moody, I think, certainly leaves a little doubt about that. Moody, as the Supreme Court said, the decision to bring a facial challenge comes at a high cost to the plaintiff, and I don't think it's one they can cash out here. Just looking at the statute, it defines... Just take one-fifth of one-half of the definitional provisions of the statute. Let's say 1A. It talks about actual or simulated representations or exhibitions. There's probably 4 iterations there. But what did the district court say? I mean, he didn't carefully go through the statute like the Supreme Court requires. He just said, well, I think cheerleading might violate the statute, so I think it's constitutionally overbroad. I think that's plainly insufficient. It was insufficient before Moody, but Moody, I mean, clarifies you have to look at the full range of the statute's applications and then do, as I think the court has said, the sort of math equation after and weigh whether the constitutional the unconstitutional applications substantially outweigh the unconstitutional ones, or the constitutional ones. And here, I mean, on the face of the statute, I mean, they're not even saying that the state can't prohibit actual sex acts being performed on stage, that the state can't prohibit lewd displays of genitals, the exhibition of sex toys, again, in a way that appeals to the prurient interest. So I want to, you know, focus on that again. It's not just sort of normal, healthy sexual desires. This is something over and above. And for an example of that, I would point you to page 3 of our brief. So I think Moody, to the extent there's any doubt, resolves it that the facial challenge can't succeed. And I see that I'm out of time. So if there's no further questions, I'll see you at rebuttal.
We'll hear from you again.
May it please the court, I'm Ray Viotto. I'm here for the city of Abilene. In its seminal 1978 Monell case, the Supreme Court stated that, quote, local governmental bodies can be sued directly under section 1983 for monetary, declaratory, and injunctive relief where the action that is alleged to be unconstitutional implements or executes a policy statement, ordinance, regulation, or decision officially adopted and promulgated by that body's officers. None of the three elements that this court has distilled as being essential for a 1983 Monell claim have been alleged, let alone proved in this case. To start off with, there is no city policy that has been promulgated or adopted by the city's officers. We're talking about a state statute here, obviously. There is no city final policymaker that has had anything to do with the adoption or promulgation of this state statute. The city council is our final policymaker. There's no allegations, no proof that the city council has done anything to adopt regulations under Senate Bill 12 or to take any action to deprive these plaintiffs of their rights. And finally, there is no allegation or proof that the city of Abilene, through any of its actions, has caused any chill of free speech of these plaintiffs. So on the merits, putting aside the standing arguments, the jurisdictional arguments, the city of Abilene should not be in this case because none of the elements have been established under Section 1983 to hold the city liable. The Supreme Court has said, and the Fifth Circuit in following it, in Robinson versus Hunt Company, that the Monell custom and policy elements apply to claims for injunctive relief just the same as they do for claims for damages.
So let me ask you, if the city council, wherever the proper body is in Abilene, indicated, adopted a policy that we will enforce state law, or specifically that we will enforce this state law, would that be enough? Asked you, it's a hypothetical. Would that be enough?
Yeah, there's no evidence that the city has adopted anything to adopt or to implement this.
I'm trying to see where your argument takes us. And so in determining that, I'm trying to ask you a hypothetical. Were the city to adopt some ordinance that it is, and we don't have to use the word policy, but that we will enforce this act, we think it's important, it's useful, it's whatever, would that be enough to create exposure for Monell liability?
You know, there are cases that will say that if the city would adopt an ordinance that would, in effect, parallel the state law and, in effect, embrace the state law as the city's own parallel policy, that could be enough. There are these cases that, you know, where the final policymaker of the city carries out the state law and follows it in an unconstitutional manner. We've seen that those cases can be enough, but where the city final policymaker has neither enforced the law in a manner that is unconstitutional or adopted a facially unconstitutional law, there is no liability. And the Eccles versus Parker, the foundation Familia Unidas versus Briscoe case, that simply following a state law.
Has the city of Abilene declared that it will not enforce this law?
It hasn't said either way. The city has taken the position that we are neutral on the law and that we will obey the federal courts in this case.
How can we determine that it won't ever do that? It won't ever enforce the law?
Well,
I mean, how can we say they're not bound by the law?
The city is only obligated to follow a state law and to the extent that it is constitutional. I mean, this is the whole issue of this pre-enforcement challenge. The city has no law on its books to follow the law as the plaintiffs claim in the broadest sense it's stated. I think that all the parties here agree that there are certain aspects of the law that are even covered by other statutes and that would not raise a constitutional problem if enforced. If, for example, the city were to adopt some regulation, which it hasn't, there's nothing to say what kind of a regulation that the city would even adopt, whether it would write a statute that would be or ordinance that would be so broad as it could be unconstitutional. But there's no evidence in this record that the city stands ready to enforce this law in an unconstitutional manner. And furthermore, and I see my time is up, unless you want me to continue.
I want you to finish the answer to Judge Dennis's question once you're satisfied your time is up. But you feel your question is answered?
Yeah.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Daniel Plake, and I'm here on behalf of Montgomery County and District Attorney Brett Ligon. My clients rely primarily on their briefing in this matter, and the county adopts Mr. Viada's Monell argument specifically as to the complete lack of a identified county policy or identified county policymaker. In addition, Montgomery County does not believe this claims are ripe against it because there is no controversy between it and the only relevant plaintiff, the Woodlands Pride. Woodlands Pride has never sought a permit from Montgomery County, has no reason to seek a permit from Montgomery County. Mr. Ligon believes there are two primary issues before the court. The first is whether in his capacity as a state prosecutor and enforcing state criminal law, he's entitled to raise sovereign immunity. And the second is if he is able to raise sovereign immunity, whether or not the allegations pled by or proven by the Woodlands Pride in this case invoke ex parte Young exception. I believe this court's most recent case in Mi Familia Volta versus Ogg answers both of these questions in favor of Mr. Ligon. Specifically, he is a state official when he is enforcing state law, and demonstrated willingness analysis or prong seems to permeate through all the elements that are necessary to reach to invoke ex parte Young exception. And because he has simply done nothing in this case, and their fear is based on their own subjective fear of being prosecuted under a statute that they believe may be interpreted the way they interpret it, and because they rely solely on the new definition of official misconduct raised in a new state statute. But neither are sufficient to attribute to Mr. Ligon as affirmative action. Specifically, Mr. Ligon is still bound by the Constitution. He cannot bring unconstitutional charges against people. Mr. Ligon is still has a duty to do justice. Justice is done, not just to prosecute people. He still has prosecutorial discretion on cases. He does not have to take every case that people bring to him. And he is still, his power and his duties flow from his general duties under the Constitution, not from a specific statute. I see I have about 30 seconds left if I can entertain any questions.
I guess not. Thank you, Counsel.
morning. Robert Wagstaff here on behalf of Taylor County and District Attorney Jim Hicks. May it please the court. Like Montgomery County, we can adopt the Monell arguments of Mr. Viotto on behalf of the City of Abilene. And Judge Dennis, specifically with what you said about we don't know what's going to happen, and that's part of the point. It's speculative to even know what's going to happen under the Monell test, and they may regulate, it doesn't say they have to, and they may regulate in some manner that isn't the moving force that is violative of any constitutional right. It's all speculative, and so there is no evidence at this point that the county or the city is going to in any way do anything that would bring them within the Monell exception under 1983.
Well, who do you represent?
I represent Taylor County and the district attorney for Taylor
County. Taylor County?
Yeah, that's where City of Abilene is located, Taylor County. So, as well as, I wanted to point out under Ex parte Young, there was testimony by the representative of the Abilene Pride Alliance that there was had been no overt action by the county as commissioners, the district attorney's office, anything that would indicate that there would be any type of enforcement. And in order to have that scintilla that this court pointed out in the Ogg case, there must be something. And in fact, if you look at you brought up the intent, Judge Engelhardt, that they said that they don't believe that any of their planned activities would be violative of State Bill 12, Senate Bill 12. So there is a question about justiciable claims there. And but if you look at the Abilene Pride Alliance specifically had people in place to monitor social media, to monitor the news media, to monitor what was going on in the county and in the city, and there was nothing that came forward that would in any way indicate that there was any plan, that there was any overt action on behalf of the district attorney's office that they were going to prosecute. Again, as y'all noted in the Hog Court, that's a discretionary function of the district attorney, and so there is nothing there. There's no scintilla to bring it under the Ex parte Young exception. And so we believe that the 1983 actions against both the county and District Attorney Hicks fail for those reasons.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Brian Klosterboer for the plaintiffs. Senate Bill 12 prohibits disfavored performances across the state of Texas. While the law's text and history are aimed at drag performances, SB 12 also extends beyond them to prohibit huge swaths of inherently expressive activities. On its face, this law restricts performances based on content, which triggers strict scrutiny, as this court held in Texas Entertainment Association versus Hager, and as the Supreme Court has held with regards to similar laws in Reno, Playboy, and Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association.
Counsel, what is it under Section 3? Seems like there are some very specific descriptions. What is it under Section 3 that one or more of your clients wish to do that the statute would infringe upon?
Yes, Your Honor. And as Your Honor knows, this court applies the test from Turtle Island Foods. So for standing purposes, plaintiffs have shown, and the district court found, that they meet each element of the five-part test for sexual conduct. A couple examples of this. The first part is any exhibition or representation, actual or simulated, of a sexual act, including those enumerated, which shows that the legislature intended to go beyond just this list. Bandit testified that she has simulated making out with someone on stage, thrusting her hips. 360 Queen talked about twerking, a performer in one instance pulsing her chest. And also Extragrams talked about twisting, shaking, shimmying the body. And although the Attorney General claims that the prurient interest provides a backstop on shimmying, shaking, thrusting your hips as a dancer or performer, even the definition the Attorney General cited from Roth
only says that the prurient interest can be defined as material that could incite lustful thoughts.
But isn't the other part of the statute that limits is the performance before a minor?
Correct, Your Honor, partially. So Section 3 does impose criminal liability anywhere that a minor reasonably could be expected to be, and Section 2 prohibits these performances on all public property, even solely among adults, which would say a community college that has a theater production, if they're having nudity, even partial nudity, or parts of, you know, a simulated sex scene. The Supreme Court did say in Southeastern Promotions versus Conrad, that involved the musical Hair. In that performance, there was nudity. There was also a simulated sex scene on stage. And there, the district court had found in that case that that was not protected by the First Amendment. This U.S. Supreme Court reversed something, even though nudity has no constitutional protection off the stage, when it's part of a performance on stage, that is fully protected and subject to constitutional scrutiny.
But we've always had limitations on age limitations on however we want to define it, period interest or the way it's defined here in Section 3. We've always had age limitations, movie ratings, R ratings, X ratings. We've had, even in the days of bookstores where pornography was available, these so-called dirty books were always segregated in the bookstore by law. We've always had age protections on performances or material that's been considered of sexually adult nature. Is that not correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And plaintiffs here are not trying to disturb that framework or challenge Ginsburg or even this court's decision in Free Speech Coalition. But importantly, each of those cases had those critical guardrails of even the material being censored had to be patently offensive with regards to minors. There was an exception, a critical exception, for works that have serious artistic, scientific, and other value. Here, that law has none of those guardrails. This law restricts performances even that have serious literary and other value. And the U.S. Supreme Court held in Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association that the government can restrict content towards minors, but it must meet strict scrutiny. And there, the state of California tried to ban very violent video games that were harmful to minors, but the court still found that the government has to meet its burden of strict scrutiny. Particularly here, this law can only be justified with reference to the content prohibited.
I suppose what I'm trying to get some definition on, and maybe you can help with this, is the where the constitutional right to expression, and we know all the cases, and you've cited all the cases, and we've talked about them here this morning, meets a constitutional right to an audience. And in this case, it seems to me the statute is fundamentally designed towards the performance in front of minors. Now, that's why I asked about the intent element, because I think there's some mention in the briefs of what if there's an accidental, you know, a young person, a child walks into one of your client's performances, whether that would qualify under the statute, because there would be no intent on behalf of the performer to perform in front of a minor. So I understand the First Amendment cases that you're talking about protected speech. I'm trying to determine how that fits into the right to protect minors, which I think we've traditionally recognized for a very long time against what we would consider to be pornography or period interest or adult performances.
Yes, Your Honor. And the Attorney General has essentially attempted to rewrite the statute in its briefs. By saying that it only really applies to performances in front of minors. But on the face of the statute, it clearly applies to any public forum, anywhere in the state, prohibiting these performances, even only among adults. And there's no intent requirement. Today, the Attorney General said the mens rea is recklessness, but there's no case that they cite that the mens rea would apply to the civil penalties for sections 1 or 2. It only provides a mens rea for Section 3, and even recklessness provides really no comfort. You know, this statute is not narrowly tailored. If there was perhaps an intent requirement, if the language was tighter, perhaps it could be more akin to Ginsburg or Free Speech Coalition, But this statute is vague. There's no case the Attorney General cites for a free-roaming, prurient interest standard. To the contrary, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in State versus Andrews said that that term, prurient interest, should not be singled out, that its definition is essentially circular, and it cannot go to the jury alone, but only within the broader context of the guardrails from
Well, let's, on the flip side, we've always also had statutes and ordinances defined as public decency ordinances. For instance, even in New Orleans, if you wanted to go in Lafayette Square and have sexual intercourse or commit an act of sodomy, that would be against the law. And we have no statute like the one that's at issue in this case. But we recognize that that would be an offense on probably state law and a local ordinance, like I said, even in New Orleans. So how would that fit in with the arguments that you're making here? You recognize that the local municipalities have legal authority for that type of legislation, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the Texas Penal Code, too, Texas already has laws on obscenity, on obscene performances, and material harmful to minors. But those laws track the language of Miller and Ginsburg. They make exceptions for works that have literary and other value. And here, that's completely absent.
Okay. Let me also ask you, refresh my memory, amongst the plaintiffs, are any of them operating commercial enterprises, clubs, performance venues, places like that?
They do, Your Honor. The district court found that at least three of the plaintiffs do exercise control. 360 Queen in particular rents out the patio of a family-owned restaurant. And although they do not own the premises, they control the space. They sell tickets, control who comes in and out. Mm-hmm. And the same thing for Abilene Pride Alliance and the Woodlands Pride. But moreover, this court also held earlier this year in Book People versus Wong that if there is a clear logical chain where a government official is enforcing a statute through a third party that's going to have a determinative effect, then the plaintiffs still have direct standing under Ex parte Young to sue that government official.
Counsel, several times you've referred in various ways to guardrails, including artistic value-related points. I know you also have problems with the absence of definitions, but would adding protection for those performances that have artistic value, the rest of the definition, would that largely cure the problems that you see in the statute? I want to see where the problems are, not that we're in the statutory rewriting business, but to what extent is that central to your argument that there is no such protection for whatever category would be relevant?
It's one element, Your Honor, but it would not salvage the statute's constitutionality. The law that the Supreme Court looked at in Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association did have a savings clause for works or video games with artistic and other value, but the Supreme Court still found that that statute did not survive strict scrutiny. Here, too, there's a number of ways that it could be more narrowly tailored, adding a scienter intent requirement, differentiating between the age of minors is another thing the district court noted. Here, we don't know whose prurient interest are we looking at. In the Sixth Circuit case that was cited by my friends on the other side, there, the Tennessee Supreme Court has a decision that said that the statute must be interpreted based on a reasonable 17-year-old. Texas does not have any case law on that. So we don't know, is the prurient interest looking at a 5-year-old or are we looking at a 17-year-old? Because Broadway musicals and works of art, as the Amici, the Dramatists Legal Defense Fund and Actors Equity Association talked about, you know, those works vary. And common, as the district court found, common everyday performances do include nudity. At the trial court, the attorney general said that even wardrobe malfunctions would be prosecuted under this statute. On appeal for the first time, they tried to rely on the word feature to say that performances must feature nudity. We believe that gives way too much weight to the word feature, that a common everyday understanding of the word could also mean a performance that includes nudity. And even regardless, there's no standard. How would police or prosecutors viewing a performance, for example, the Super Bowl where Janet Jackson had a wardrobe malfunction, that was the only aspect of that performance that anyone talked about, but it was a momentary second. So was that featured in that performance? Here, the statute is silent, and that's what makes it vague, because prosecutors and a jury don't even know what question to answer. How would they determine what appeals to a prurient interest when that word is not defined? We don't know even whose prurient interest we're talking about. Ginsburg, and even this court's decision in Free Speech Coalition, require that the prurient interest be based on taking the work as a whole, a reasonable person standard, and community standards. Here, the statute omits all of those terms, and the author of the bill in the Senate testified that they knew that they were discarding all of the guardrails of Miller and not following that. So it's a job for the legislature to try to rewrite this law, not the courts. Additionally, in terms of standing, Your Honor, the Attorney General mentioned there was no evidence that plaintiffs sought to be nude at performances, and although they do not seek to be nude under our common understanding of that term, this law defines nudity as any partial showing of the buttocks or the breast below the top of the areola. So that would prohibit performers. Bandit testified at 1582 that she often shows cleavage, that she's worn thongs and leotards on stage that reveal parts of her buttocks. 360 Queens similarly testified that their performers have worn string bikinis that are, quote, very, very revealing around the buttocks. Extragrams also testified that wardrobe malfunctions, which the Attorney General said would be prosecutable, happen all the time, that performers wear leotards where it does show part of the butt. And even the Woodlands Pride also testified that they've had performers showing cleavage that would show part of the breast below the areola, as well as portions of their butt. And as I mentioned, you know, the Supreme Court has explained in Southeastern Promotions versus Conrad that things that might be pure conduct off the stage, such as nudity or a simulated sex scene, when they are part of a performance, they are protected by the First Amendment. Here, this statute only targets performances. It only targets things that are a visual performance. So the plaintiffs need not prove that categorically every performance in the universe is constitutionally protected. That's not the test. In Southeastern Promotions versus Conrad, the Supreme Court wrote that our aversion to censorship is deep written in our law. And the burden is on the censor, the government, to prove that it has the constitutional authority to censor or prohibit these performances. This court reached that same conclusion in Texas Entertainment Association versus Hager. That regulation at issue basically charged a fee to semi-nude dancers. And even though nudity itself is not constitutionally protected, because those exotic dancers were engaging in expressive activity, this court applied strict scrutiny to that regulation.
Counsel, what is your interpretation of First Amendment law? How clearly defined does the message of expressive conduct have to be? There's argued by the state that you need some commenter on the stage to say what the expression you've just seen means, support for gay rights, whatever else. What's your interpretation of why the First Amendment would even apply to what your clients are doing?
Yes, Your Honor. The test from Texas versus Johnson about something having to convey a particular, having an intent to convey a message that would be understood really applies only to conduct. Things like burning a draft card, burning a flag, hanging a peace sign upside down outside your house, wearing an armband. You know, those are things that, just by their very nature, are not inherently expressive. To the contrary, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Ward versus Rock Against Racism that things like music you know, by their very nature, are inherently expressive. The same thing in Southeastern Promotions versus Conrad. When things are on stage, as the Supreme Court said, mixing, dancing with the spoken word, with singing, they are inherently expressive. And the U.S. Supreme Court in Hurley, even looking at parades, found that those are inherently expressive. It need not have one particularized message. And so here, you know, we don't believe the Texas versus Johnson test is the test to follow here, that we don't have to show that all performances are categorically have a message or would be understood by the audience. This law only targets performances. The Attorney General does not point to any performance that would not be constitutionally protected. Here, they are not disputing that plaintiffs' performances are constitutionally protected. We meet that part of the statute to have standing, and on its face, you know, this statute is overbroad because it's only targeting really it could possibly be applied to obscene performances. That would be the only legitimate application of this statute with the constitutional authority. Otherwise, it's targeting non-obscene performances, and in order to do that, to drive those performances from public view, the state of Texas has to meet its burden of strict scrutiny.
So you're saying the only possible constitutional application of this is to performances of nudity, and that answers the Moody question?
So Moody is instructive, Your Honor, particularly there. The Supreme Court, or this court, had analyzed that law looking at the heartland of how the statute would be applied, primarily looking at the news feeds of Facebook and YouTube. And the Supreme Court said that the courts need to look beyond that, at the broader breadth and applications of the statute. Here, the district court did that. The district court found that there was robust and overwhelming evidence in the legislative record that this law is aimed at drag performances, and that subsection 5 of the sexual conduct definition, the text of the law, also takes aim at drag performances because it prohibits the exaggeration of male or female sexual characteristics using accessories or prosthetics. But the district court did not limit its analysis only to the heartland of what this law is getting at. It also applied more broadly, looking at plain language like brief partial nudity, how that would prohibit, you know, professional cheerleaders, any representation or simulation of a sexual act, even the part of the statute regarding potential sex toys, that part would also prohibit. There's no savings clause for works or performances with scientific value. So even a sex ed instructor who is using a dildo as a prop or a medical school, that too could be swept up under the law. And then the Attorney General also does not really challenge the part of the statute that prohibits any touching of performers, even a representation, a simulated touching of the breast or butt of any performer. We know that many types of dancing, from the ballet to modern dancing, and they call it fanciful, that the district court would say that it does apply to cheerleading, dancing, live performances, but it's not fanciful. It comes from the plain text of the statute. And because this law has such steep criminal penalties, including up to a year in jail, as well as civil fines of up to $10,000, the plain text of the law, if not enjoined, has a profound chilling effect, as the Amici Actors Equity Association and Dramatists Legal Defense Fund elaborate on, potentially applying to dozens of common musicals and hit shows across the state. Turning briefly, Your Honors, to some of the ex parte Young arguments. The local defendants don't mention or cite this court's decision in National Press Photographers Association versus McCraw. Earlier this year, the court held that district attorneys are properly subject to a pre-enforcement challenge under the First Amendment for declaratory injunctive relief. The defendants do not cite that case. Instead, they cite to Mi Familia Vota, which we agree can be read in harmony with McCraw and also with the Supreme Court precedent that prosecutors are often proper targets for ex parte Young challenges to newly enacted criminal laws. Mi Familia Vota is factually distinct for three key reasons. First, the prosecutor there offered to stipulate that she would not enforce the law, Here, none of the defendants have disavowed enforcement. And moreover, Mi Familia Vota also preceded a new Texas law, Texas Local Government Code 87.011, that now limits prosecutors' discretion. In Mi Familia Vota, the prosecutor claimed unlimited discretion, that she could refuse categorically to enforce the law at issue. Here, the district court found that this new law, called HB 17 in the district court's decision, does constrain prosecutors' authority to categorically say that they will not prosecute. And because of the new law and the prosecutor's refusal to disavow this law, that provides the scintilla, the mere scintilla that this court requires to show a demonstrated willingness to enforce. The prosecutors don't meaningfully contest that they have a duty to enforce this statute. Indeed, Section 3, the only possible officers who could enforce Section 3 are the local prosecutors. And as this court noted in Mi Familia Vota, the threat of criminal prosecution is the pinnacle of compulsion or constraint. And so having this statute go into effect, it has never been in effect because it's been blocked in this pre-enforcement challenge, but the threat of enforcement, if the prosecutors do not disavow it, itself has a chilling effect on plaintiffs' First Amendment rights. And Mi Familia Vota should be read in harmony with the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions dating back to Steffel versus Thompson, as well as Virginia versus American Booksellers. American Booksellers is particularly instructive. There, the Supreme Court allowed a pre-enforcement challenge against a prosecutor to go forward. There was a criminal law targeting material harmful to minors. The prosecutor had never enforced or seemingly threatened to enforce that law, but the court explained it was not troubled by the pre-enforcement nature of this suit. The state has not suggested that the newly enacted law will not be enforced, and we see no reason to assume otherwise. The alleged danger of this statute is in large measure one of self-censorship, a harm that can be realized even without an actual prosecution. And particularly, it would be too late to force the plaintiffs to wait until a prosecution begins, because if a prosecution starts against the plaintiffs, younger abstention would apply, and plaintiffs would never have their day in federal court. So they would be forced to, their First Amendment rights would be violated if they were not able to bring a pre-enforcement challenge. With regards to Monell liability, the municipalities here are proper defendants. The text of Section 1983 itself says that any person acting under color of state law who violates someone's constitutional rights is a proper defendant. As the municipalities acknowledge, they are not immune. They are persons under 1983. And acting under color of state law is no defense. It's the very purpose of 1983 to authorize such suits. Abilene cited the case Familias Unidas versus Briscoe. That case actually cuts against them. If you look carefully at that case, there a judge was found to be acting on behalf of the state when the judge enforced state law. But there was also a local school board in that case, which is a municipality in Texas. And this court in Familias Unidas held that the municipality was liable when it took action to enforce state law. Now that case is a little bit different because it was not a pre-enforcement challenge, but it stands for the proposition that merely enforcing state law is no defense to municipalities. They are persons under 1983, like any person who could be sued under 1983, acting under color of state law is no defense. There is not a case directly on point with the posture we have here in this pre-enforcement challenge. It is somewhat of a unique context for the legislature to specifically task municipalities with enforcing this law. But here it would turn, it would conflict with the purposes of Section 1983 and Monell. And the key point, the takeaway from the cases that defendants cite, is that municipalities can only be liable for an official policy or custom. It is not true that the official policy or custom has to come from the actual policymakers. For example, there are cases like the city of Austin versus Rourke, where the voters of a municipality have enacted a policy or ordinance that then is properly subjects the municipality to Monell liability. And there, and like in Familius Unius versus Briscoe, even if the legislature enacts a law, there is no case or nothing stopping the plaintiffs from being able to sue pre-enforcement. It's the very text of Section 2 itself that prohibits all of these performances on all public property across the state, even solely among adults. That has a chilling effect if it is allowed to go into effect, and the statute on its face specifically tasks the municipalities with enforcing it. They are not immune, and all we're asking for in this case is injunctive and declaratory relief. So we're not seeking damages, and this court is well within its authority to reach this question. But to the extent that the court need not address it, the district court also importantly found the statute is not severable. Despite the existence of a severability clause, the entire statute hinges on the definitions in Section 3, and all of those definitions hinge on the free-roaming use of the term prurient interest in sex, which, as we said, is content-based discrimination, is also vague and overbroad. So the Attorney General does not point to any element or any particular part of Section 3 that could stand on its own. So the entire statute is not severable. This court need not reach the questions about Ex parte Young and Monell if it finds standing as to at least one plaintiff against the Attorney General, and if it reaches the merits with regards to at least one plaintiff against the Attorney General, and it finds that the statute is not severable. In closing, the government cannot restrict non-obscene performances based on content without meeting its burden of strict scrutiny. As Justice Scalia wrote for the majority in Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association, it is difficult to distinguish politics from entertainment and dangerous to try. And the government lacks the free-floating power to restrict the ideas to which children may be exposed. As the founder of the Woodlands Pride testified before the district court, democracy, liberation, and freedom of speech are what he fought for as a veteran of the Iraq War. But Senate Bill 12 would force the Woodlands Pride and other plaintiffs to abandon drag shows or drive them into the shadows. Our Constitution does not permit the government to drive non-obscene performances from public view without meeting strict scrutiny. The enforcers of this law, including the Attorney General, the municipalities, and the prosecutors, should continue to be enjoined from chilling plaintiffs' First Amendment rights. Unless there are any further questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
Just a few points in rebuttal, if I might, a couple on the First Amendment merits, and then I'll return to standing. My friend on the other side said that they don't have to show that these performances regulated by the text of the statute are inherently expressive. But of course he does. Again, this is a facial challenge. What that argument invites the court to do is exactly what the Supreme Court reversed the lower courts for doing in Moody. What is that? Treating the case as an as-applied one instead of a facial one. That is the exact thing the Supreme Court said you can't do in the context of a facial challenge. And you hear it's exactly what they're asking you to do because they say, but look, our performances are expressive. But again, when you get to the merits of the First Amendment statute, this is even before Moody, the Freedom Path case, you focus only on the text and look at its applications. And when we get to the facial challenge, the task is, of course, to consider the constitutional applications versus the unconstitutional ones. And so long as the constitutional ones outweigh the unconstitutional ones, it can't be held overbroad.
What's your response to opposing counsel's statement that the case law on performances is self-evident, that performances are expressive?
Well, I think it's interesting that all the cases they point to are as-applied cases. I think that's telling. But I'll go to Conrad, which I think is what they talk about. That's about the case Hare. None of it said that all performances at all times are inherently expressive, but I'm not even saying that's the issue. We're not talking about performances simpliciter in the statute. We're talking about a certain type of statutorily defined sexually oriented performances. And what are those? Those are performances that involve nudity. Those are performances that involve defined sexual conduct. None of those things are inherently expressive. The case law is pellucid about that. And as Judge Higginbotham said in the Hang On case involving a touching ordinance for strip clubs in Dallas, at some point that the type of conduct overwhelms any expressive elements that could possibly be in there. I mean, the Supreme Court in Dallas versus Stanglin said it's possible to find a kernel of expression in so almost every activity. But again, we're talking about things here that involve appeal to the prurient interest in sex. I think that is a complete what my friend on the other side said about cheerleading, live musicals, ballet, science experiments. I'm sorry, I'm unaware of what type of cheerleading they're referring to, but the type of cheerleading I'm familiar with, and I think you are familiar with, it's not prurient. It doesn't appeal to some kind of morbid sexual desire or something like that. At best, it's a normal, healthy sexual desire, and again, that's the Supreme Court in Bennett. And if it really were the case that we thought that cheerleading appealed to the prurient interest in sex, I imagine the FCC would have something to say about the Dallas Cowboy football games. But none of those things appeals to the prurient interest in sex, so that's a complete answer to the sort of, again, it's fanciful, it's speculative, that's the Supreme Court in Hansen on this issue. Again, I want to impress on the court again, this is a facial challenge, so it's not enough for them to say, well, my performances are expressive. That may be the case, but that doesn't answer the facial challenge question. The last thing on that I want to note is that this was a trial. So I think it may well be appropriate for the court to render on that issue and not just remand. I don't know that Moody established a sort of new legal standard that would require a remand to the district court in the first instance. I think the court could render on this and take note that there is no evidence in the record. The analysis was quite perfunctory. I mean, if the Supreme Court thought Judge Oldham's analysis in the net choice case was not up to snuff on the facial analysis, I don't see how the district court's sort of mere speculation that maybe ballet and cheerleading are barred by the statute is enough. I'll quickly turn the standing, unless there's anything else in the First Amendment that you want to issue. I note that they go straight to Bandit and 360 Queen to say, well, they want to engage in conduct barred by the statute. But of course, Bandit and 360 Queen perform at adults-only shows, 21 and up. So they don't violate the statute. So it's not relevant if they're wearing thongs and string bikinis and things like that, because they're doing it not in front of minors. They're not doing it on public land either. They're doing it in bars and clubs and private venues. So that is, I don't think that's going to get them standing on that point. And the same goes for nudity. This is any type of nudity, the covering of a butt cheek or something like that, is at those shows. To the extent that it's a wardrobe malfunction, again, the statute says what it says, feature says what it says, and a feature, as their own definition, a characteristic demonstrates, it has to be a defining feature so of the performance, and an aberration like a malfunction is not. I see I'm almost out of time, so unless the court has any questions, we'd ask you to reverse and render, and I note we have a stay motion pending as well on that.
All right, counsel, thanks to all of you who've helped us in our understanding of this case. We will take it under advisement.